Okay, so it's Tuesday the 10th of January, 7:30 p.m. I'm here at OMHQ, Occupy Melbourne's safe base at Father Bob's Parish in South Melbourne, at the Healing and Meditation Centre of the First Aid and Care Team. And Jason of the First Aid and Care Team has organised this spoken word sort of storytelling event, the idea being for everyone to sit in the Healing and Meditation Centre and for it to be, I think, a bit of a cathartic kind of thing for people to... incredible amounts of crazy shit that has occurred throughout this whole adventure, and hopefully purge some of the negativity that admittedly has accumulated in various spheres, because it's been a very difficult time, which thankfully we seem to have largely passed through now. And I might hand over to Jason if he's available to sort of lead in the whole thing, or he'll probably do it when we start anyway, but thought it would be good to record it. So that's what this is. All right, 8 p.m. fact thing starting proper. I'd catalogue the attendees, but I don't know all their names. Doesn't really matter.
How does this work?
Who wants to get us started?
You go.
You do it, mate.
Seriously.
Can everyone give us a wave? Okay, spoken word in effect. Wavy McQuarrie. Done that before. I can tell.
All the fame and glory that media brings us.
Oh, this is weird. Let me get a drink first. I got a mouthful of meringue. Can't figure that one out yet.
So.
Where's my life vest? I want a life vest.
I'm confused now. Sorry.
Kind of liked it.
It was kind of, I did have Bridget in my name before that. It wasn't a complete change.
Before I travelled, I was really into understanding pre-Romano-Christian England and understanding the nation, the landscape by the word. Not so much the written word, but the stories that people told about the landscape and how they related to them. And this was back when my hair wasn't quite as shorn as it is today. and I learnt a lot about myself through stories, and look, we lost so many stories when the Romans came over, and I got into lots of storytelling, going around to hand fastings and travelling England, and that was the last time I had a sense of being part of a tribe. Cut my hair, thought I'd reinvent myself as Doctor Who and travel the world and feed a bit of a hedonist, but there's no denying that I miss that sense of being part of a tribe, being part of something. I've never had that feeling until I joined this fucked up movement. This sense of community, this sense of tribe, as warty and as ugly and as clumsy as it is, that sense of belonging. And it's weird because I'm not doing that in relation to the landscape anymore. I'm doing that in relation to your country, your mores, your history. And it's been really humbling for me. And I know we've had a really rough time, but we've also had some beautiful moments. And I kind of really wanted this evening to be one of those kind of beautiful moments, and I know there's only a few of us here, but it doesn't really matter, because I know, words are words. Another thing was, before I did this, I wrote lots of stories, I'm an author, blah blah blah. My ticket out of nursing was writing, and I've been writing for like the last 7 years this science fiction series called Maltworld. I got like 200 fans worldwide to check me out.
What's it called?
Maltworld. Maltworld. The first time I went scuba diving and I saw all this coral and all this crazy fluorescent stuff, I realised no words could ever capture the beauty of it as a real alien world, and I thought, this is paradise. And I kind of thought, take the whole settlers and nomads going to a new world, and it's usually the world is the enemy and they're being heroes and they're taming the land. Well, Maltworld's different. Maltworld is an alien planet that welcomes people. It's paradise. And the settlers in the Maltworld, there's only about 500-600 of them, and I'm probably one of about 70 stories now about it. And you know, it's a typical Moray, but it's the people who are spoiled Maltworld. So this is one of the first Maltworld stories. I deliberately chose it because it's very poignant to Occupy Melbourne. It's called Of Clouds and Dirt, a Maltworld fable. On our first night on the strange and fantastic planet we came to call Maltworld, we dug a fire pit. It would have taken just a snuggle from a loved one to keep warm that night. But we dug a fire pit nevertheless. Old travel chests and suitcases were our benches. The flames licked our knees like a kindly old cat's tongue. The blaze mirrored our excitement, rosy and bright. We were aglow with a new optimism. We were the first eight. We sang, we danced, and when the fire shrank into embers, we huddled and planned utopia. We leaned close and whispered conspiratorially, the fire's orange blush on our features, adding what seemed to be historical significance to our every word. We would learn from the mistakes of human history. We would forge a benevolent society, one in which personal happiness would equate to group happiness. Rationality would replace dogma. Acceptance instead of prejudice. Cooperation instead of competitiveness. But on that principle-filled night, not one of us mentioned it. Our first dawn in Malt World was heralded by the singing of the Water Weirds. Their songs coalesced inside bubbles, floated free of the lake until surface tension popped them and their notes tinkled free onto the surface. The weirds, translucent beneath the water, seemed to observe us, their turquoise shimmering features unreadable, alien. We gathered floating fronds from the lake's edge. The fronds resembled kelp and eaten raw tasted good, almost like custard. It was easy to reach into the depths and scoop at the small fish that glittered there. And as we sat on the banks of the lake and ate this watery harvest, we vowed we would return to a lifestyle in sync with the natural world. We would strive for true sustainability and return as much to the planet as we took from it. But as the water weirds looked on and we stuffed our bellies, not one soul mentioned it. The leading of our friends and family from the old world was a subtle affair which took months. Each return was meticulously planned, and inevitably those left behind had much time on their hands. Plenty could have been achieved in that time, but instead we sat around, we played. The air had never been breathed before. The water was delightfully pure as a formula, H2O. The harvest from the lake was equaled by the harvest of the land. Berries bejeweled the hedgerows, and no shortage of fruit hung from what seemed like perpetually pregnant trees. What else was there to do but to eat, to make love, and to fall over drunk from the wines and spirits that each mission insisted on bringing back from the old world? We were the new hedonists, luxuriating in true liberty. No one would tell us what to do ever again. Never had humanity witnessed such individualism. So, why spoil the party by mentioning it? Eventually, my brother could no longer sustain the journeys back and forth from the old world. Those last few missions were less about leading the chosen ones back to the planet and more about procuring supplies. Supplies we thought we could not do without. Upon the banks of the lake, a makeshift pyramid of cases, bags, tools and supplies sprang up. Then the journey stopped. We were on our own. The time had come to get serious. Our spirits sank at the enormity of our isolation. We picked through the pyramid of supplies, despairing at the futility of 80% of the things we had brought. Roof, warmth, and food were of essence now. Not sleek gadgets with desirable contours and the promise of upgrades. The iPod cemetery held its first internment that day. Fortunately, Malt World provides. She provided us and soon construction was underway. The first Earthship habitat was built in just under a month. The tools we used took on mythical identities. Each spade and hammer grew famous and became one of us. But at the same time, we busily trumpeted that we had no need for possessions. We were non-materialists. We would reinvent communism. We drank to our success, and at that very first habitat, we held a feast to rival that of any feudal lord. And as we stuffed our digestive tracts, we never once mentioned it. That first habitat became our great hall, a place of meetings and debate. Under its arching roof, we set boldly forth to define our ideology. The eaves filled with the sound of healthy discourse as our community tried to give a name to itself. Were we a commune or integrated community? Could we truly live an ethical existence? Individualists and anarchists rallied for no leaders, but we were left stupefied with certain folks of an anachronistic bent who pushed for a return to pre-Romano Christian values, and even to a chieftainship. Capitalists cried for something, anything to base a currency upon. The pagans advised we harmonise with the spirit of nature, whilst the Edenists were desperate to open our eyes to the fact that we were living in his garden and needed to start paying him some dues. So the nights grew long and the debates grew rich, and as we tried on whatever label or badge fitted us at the time, the great hall filled with so many words, but not one spent on mentioning it. Until, that is, the water weirds returned to us that which we had been depositing in their lake for so long. To this day, we do not know if we had offended them or if they thought they were being helpful. The wave rose ceremoniously from the lake's depths. As it rolled solemnly closer, we could perceive the weirds glistening, shifting forms within. But there was something else within that wave. As it grew heavy, it heaved more and more flotsam and jetsam from the bowels of the lake. The water was no longer crystal clear and was suddenly menacingly muddied. Dark shapes and smears dotted the wave as it crawled closer and closer to the shore, where gently, and with what appeared to be delicate good manners, it deposited a year's worth of our defecation on the ground. In this land of unbreathed air and uncontaminated H2O, where hedges offered us their bejeweled riches and food was always good and never ever scarce, no one had once wanted to talk about one simple honest fact, that even in paradise we defecate. Our heads in the clouds, we ignored our duty to dirt, but now the time had come to cut the crap and at last talk shit. I'm stuck in the
chair. Oh, that's cool. You can follow that.
Devil, but I'm not going to talk all night long.
Oh. 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 Really,
I'm a doctor.
We love you, Jess.
I'm a nurse.
Alrighty. Most of you probably know that during the day, I'm supposed to be a historian. I haven't been able to do very much work, but I am developing some career in history. When you're dealing with left-wing politics and history, it's very easy to fall into your own traps and to listen to only people who support your argument. And one of the most important and valuable things as a historian is to talk to people who you don't actually agree with, because apart from anything else, the things that people say when they use an argument leave out different things and include different things, and you can't get a full picture of what's happened until you've talked to everyone. I don't particularly like Robert Menzies. A lot of my focus has been studying the Australian Communist Party during the 40s, and he's sort of the ogre of money and capitalism and all that is wrong with the world. So I suppose it's a bit strange that I would read a book which is letters to his daughter from him, but it's a deeply personal collection of letters, and it provides a very different view of Robert Menzies, even from those who supported him during the day. This is a very different look at the man, and because of the very intense and intimate relationship between him and his daughter, the things that come out in this book can change anyone's mind about Robert Menzies as a man. Maybe not his politics, but as a man. And that's very useful for writing history. This isn't so much about him personally, but it's a bit about his politics. And funnily enough, I think it does actually relate to Occupy Melbourne in a huge way, because people always say the world's getting worse as we go along, and back in my day it was better and all that sort of thing. But as I was saying before, Robert Menzies is held as the archetype, the founding father of the Liberal Party, and he's held in very high esteem. But he had very severe criticisms of the world as it was going in the 1960s and onwards. And what I'm going to read here is a letter that he wrote to Felix Frankfurter, who was the Secretary of State to the United States government during the early 1960s. And this is just after John F. Kennedy had won the election in 1960, I think it was, when he'd gone up against Richard Nixon, who, before JFK had come onto the scene, was seen as more or less the successor to Eisenhower. And the things that he talks about, specifically to do with John F. Kennedy and money, are very potent for today and today's politics, which is why I wanted to read it out, because it's such an unusual place to find this lesson. I agree with what you say about the presidential election. Indeed, the results have expressly justified your prophecy. My own belief is that the fantastic television debates defeated Nixon. When the campaign began, he was immeasurably better known than Kennedy. If Kennedy had had to make his own running by individual television appearances, Nixon would have remained better known and might have won. But all that Nixon did by agreeing to the debates was to present Kennedy with an audience, not of a few millions, but of 60 or 70 millions, and in the not-so-long run, make him every bit as well-known to the public eye as Nixon himself. These things, of course, were not debates at all. They were more like quiz kid performances, in which the whole accent seemed to be placed on gabbling as many words as possible into 2.5 minutes. I observed no pause for reflection, nor any indication that any mental processes were going on at all. I have a narrow-minded idea that the only people who are competent to judge debating are debaters. Members of Parliament can see through the falsity of an argument pretty smartly because they know the rules of the game and they know the tricks of the trade. 70 million people can't judge a debate because they know neither the rules nor the tricks. But they mistake fluency for strength and a good memory for a wonderful grasp of affairs. I looked at two of the debates and I was horrified to think that such a travesty could influence the public choice to the greatest office on earth. The ridiculous and dangerous argument about Quemoy was, I think, a perfect example of how not to campaign. Each candidate put himself into a position from which, if elected, he might well find it essential to retreat before long. The President of the United States ought to come to office with plenty of room for manoeuvre, with his broad attitudes stated and known, and his general character and ability understood. Neither candidate seemed to me to understand these central truths. I think that one of the troubles, particularly in America, is that too much money is spent on elections. Vast sums are raised and have to be spent. Your big businessman, who in 99 cases out of 100 is ignorant of public questions, thinks that the right way to get his candidate in is to hire the most expensive public relations experts. They attend to a range of matters stretching from high-powered thinking on policy to the art of makeup before the bright lights. The trouble about all of them is that they know nothing about politics. They proceed to apply this most subtle and elusive subject the same principles as they apply to selling palm olive soap. As the candidates themselves have far more speeches to make than they can possibly think out, they rely more and more on the backroom boys, and therefore go along delivering wordy effusions that have no imprint of any humanity or personality. I believe most firmly that if a leader is to lead, he must make his own speeches, do his own thinking, and be politely deaf to the so-called expert. If he sticks to these simple rules, he will at least be accepted or rejected on his merits, and will not find himself, 6 months later, confronted by an election effusion and saying to himself, "I wonder what they meant when they wrote that for me."
Do you think Nixon could do a decent mic check?
Yeah,
it'd be interesting.
Yes.
Maybe I should do the shorter one. Life, believe, is not a dream, so dark as sages say. Oft a little morning rain foretells a pleasant day. Sometimes there are clouds of gloom, but there are transient all. If the shower will make the roses bloom, oh why lament its fall? Rapidly, merrily, life's sunny hours slip by. Gratefully, cheerily, enjoy them as they fly. What though death at times steps in and calls our best away? What though sorrow seems to win over our hope, our heavy sway? Yea, hope again, a late springs, unconquered though she fell, still buoyant are her golden wings, still strong to bear as well. Manfully, fearlessly the day of trial bear, vigorously, victoriously can courage quell a despair. Charlotte Bronte, life.
Who was that?
Girls up.
When I was a kid at school, I had a music teacher who told me that
flutes, for example, were handcrafted back in the day. So each town and each artist drilled their holes in different spots on the flute. So each town had a parochial sort of noise or sound come out of their instruments, unique. But then the Industrial Revolution came along and all the holes were drilled into the flute in the same spot and the sound became homogenised. And she went on to explain that, in her opinion, this is what had happened to humanity, to us, to our culture. And today I haven't really got, you know, a story similar to Brother Jason's or Will's in, you know, sort of some sequence. It's just ideas that I'm going to share. So, and I'll refer to Blake, William Blake, first. And he says that those who will teach a child to doubt from the grave will never get out. And I see that that's how, you know, wherever our leaders led us, you know, like there's famine, there's war, there's environmental destruction, cultural destruction, and essentially, you know, amongst the brothers and sisters here, we're revolutionaries. We know what freedom of speech is and, you know, freedom of expression. But, you know, out there, I stood at the train station yesterday and the majority of the brothers and sisters that, you know, are part of the 99% are docile and emotionally muted. And that's great, you know, the leaders love that. You know, where have they led us? They've led us into slavery and, you know, they sit there lording above us and, you know, sitting there, you know, and we're plugging data into a computer that doesn't need us to, you know, it's just there to control us and keep us working 57,600 hours so that we can, you know, own some 19 square piece of, you know, and do you really own it, you know? Property's theft, in my opinion. He goes on to explain in the same poem, The Auguries of Innocence, he talks about the starving dog at the gate predicts the future of the state, and that's sort of where I see us, we're on the cusp of that, with economical, you know, disasters and environmental disasters happening around the world. It's not something that's going to be long before, you know, people are starving or, you know, homeless en masse, not just, you know, small minorities. And that paints, you know, a picture that we're hitting 8 billion, but that's unsustainable. I see sort of hard times ahead. And I like, you know, Nietzsche's sort of opinion that he says gratitude is for dogs. And he goes on to explain that healthcare or education, we don't have to sort of be like a dog waiting for our master to toss us a bone. We don't need to be grateful for it. It's our right as a human to have quality healthcare and quality education and empower us, but that's not really the way the system's designed. It's kept, you know, one certain standard of healthcare and education for the rich so that they can rub elbows and become judges and, you know, whatever they want to become. Whereas, you know, I see examples where schools, you know, they've got no heating and people have to turn up with blankets, and how are these kids meant to learn and power their brains and analytically think and process and, you know, see their way out of the disaster that's sort of, you know, ahead of us. So I'll finish off with a poem I wrote. It's a haiku, and haikus are typically about nature, but I've written about the nature of society, and it's called Comrade. And before I do, the word proletarian, it's typically associated with communism, but proletarian was a word, it's an ancient Roman word, it's, you know, it's over 2,000 years old, and it means a citizen whose only worth to society is their labour or their offspring, and then in turn their offspring's labour. So it's a construct that's been around for a couple of thousand years. We've been slaves for a couple of thousand years. Egypt, pyramids, nothing's really changed, just the social engineering has refined itself to keep us docile and not asking questions and not knowing about, you know, our freedoms. But then, you know, you go into the city and city square and you occupy a city square and you see the response you know, that the police or the institutions of the powers that be will unleash on people who dare to express their freedom of speech or their rights. So, on to my haiku. It's called Comrade. The dangled carrot, pit mule aches in the harness, circling round and round. And he's to stop circling round and round, brothers and sisters. Let's break out of his harness and take our rights.
That's nicer. Yeah. Mine's much more contemporary than some, and I haven't written it, but I've just been hardly had any sleep because I found a wonderful website called Occupy Writers, and it's got fantastic stories. And what really struck me was how much I could relate to the experiences of people on the other side of the world in a really humorous way in some circumstances. So this is a story by Rachel Signer. It's called Mic Checked. First, you tried drinking a lot in bars with your friends or people who seemed like they could be your friends, but it was expensive and you kept getting up late for work. So you tried online dating and went to wine bar after wine bar, tapas restaurants and gallery openings until finally you found someone to bunker down with for a while. That ended, or perhaps never really began, and next you tried reading critical theory at night, a glass of wine by your side, or taking knitting classes, learning Portuguese online. Museums, there's always something new to see in the museums. You see movies, movie after movie after movie, a few new outfits here and there, yoga. You do lots of yoga. You advance in your practice. Maybe you do a teacher training. Then one day you hear about the kids sleeping in the park around Wall Street. You've been there, done that, before you hit the real world and became focused on your career. You remember activism fondly and hope the kids have fun and make some cool signs or enjoy letting their body hair grow long. Or make some bankers feel bad about themselves. You shrug. You're doing your part to get by. You're shopping at the farmer's market. You read Chomsky. You even criticise the New York Times. You do yoga. Your online dating profile reflects your ambivalence towards the bourgeois, heteronormative standard of romance, while clearly expressing that you're available for drinks with a good-looking so-and-so of a certain pedigree who has the same excellent taste that you do. Everything's just going fine. But then curiosity gets the best of you, and anyway, Radiohead is rumoured to be playing. They don't show, and instead you find yourself in the General Assembly. People are talking about the possibility of a new society and screaming, "Mic check!" and wearing strange costumes, and the food is great, and you start seeing people you know, and you remember liking those people at the time you knew them, but not actually knowing them very well. And a week later, one of them sends you a text message saying to come to the park now, there's a march, and he doesn't have anyone around him, and he's afraid of being arrested. Soon you're walking over the Brooklyn Bridge and below you 700 people are facing scores of cops and the people in the front line have their arms linked, but you see the fear in their eyes as the cops start dragging people off one by one to the waiting vans. The people scream out their names to the crowd on the bridge above and you tell people to tweet the names with the hashtag so they get publicised. Before you know it, you're spending the afternoon in the park, dancing to the drummers, gorging on free pizza, talking to everyone. The press makes you laugh. They seem clueless or bored as they meander through the crowd, snapping pictures of the weirdest looking people they can find. You remember that you, unlike most of them, understand what's going on here. You realise that understanding is something special, something to hold on to. There are meetings and they both excite you and fill you with impatience. The General Assembly seems to drag on, and you think to yourself that this system is so flawed, so confusing and bureaucratic. A small spark inside you goes off, a secret hope that this will all end, will fail, the kids will go home and go back to hacking or running info shops or whatever they do, and you can continue on with movies and online dating and reading Mille Plateaus. But then you can't help yourself and you start asking questions, start mic checking at assembly meetings, start going to working group meetings and using the consensus process like it's a language you were born knowing. You finally sit through almost an entire, painfully long, frustrating, argumentative General Assembly and come to appreciate that it's really fucking hard to keep this movement going.
You see the tent city slowly emerge and the problems it causes, and the comfort people and the sanitation crew and the medics working their asses off to mitigate issues that come up. You ask yourself if you would be able to sacrifice comfort and ownership to sleep here. You're not sure. You join working groups. You speak confidently at meetings about potential actions. Your position on the question of demands changes over time. You are one of the skeptics who needed demands to lend concreteness to the movement, to provide a vision of change, kind of like how Obama's Yes We Can made you feel all warm and fuzzy inside just a few years ago. You wanted demands coated in sugar to suck on like throat lozenges, but as the days go by, you stop caring about demands and instead you start feeling sick at the way the NYPD treats the occupiers. You grow excited that the Spokes Council is kicking off and can streamline the structure of the movement. You start having serious conversations about problems in society and how they affect you, and you stop going to the movies. You close down your online dating profile. You don't read on the subway because you are busy thinking about conversations you've had, and you look around at other people and wonder what they're thinking about. Are they thinking? Was I thinking before? And if you were thinking, you begin to forget about everything you were thinking about. New thoughts occupy your mind. Mic check, mic check! We need to discuss the impartiality of the facilitators. Mic check. We need money for a battery pack. Mic check. What do we see as the next step for this movement? Mic check. Student loan debt betrays the American dream. Mic check. Can we get a temperature check on this proposal? Mic check. Mic check. Mic check. And you realise that it's not a dream, not a spectacle, and not a trend on Twitter. It's a sweaty mass of bodies. It's a cold, hard, concrete ground. It's a looming and armed police force. And it's a careful orchestration of radically different opinions and needs and values and beliefs. You find yourself returning day after day to the park to participate in an ongoing think tank where people speak freely about their anger, their confusion, about their visions for a better world, about the meaning of all that surrounds you in the park. And one day, you are sitting with that group discussing the role of celebrities and public figures in the movement, and a man says that we are all intellectuals, we are the celebrities, the ones worth celebrating. This is the people's think tank and our ideas matter. And then it hits you that your mind and soul until now had been colonized. You had so completely relinquished the notion of ever demanding a better world, a better life for yourself and for those who suffer alongside you and more profoundly than you, that you would simply prefer that your imagination shut down entirely. Instead of occupying the spaces that cause you to feel pain, to be isolated, to be lonely, instead of believing that a better world can exist, you have hidden away from those spaces, pretending they didn't exist, masked them with cheap wine and internet chat and downward dog. And just as the group is concurring on the need for the movement to treat celebrities as normal people, Russell Simmons shows up and demands to skip stack before he's late for yoga. He is denied and sulks. I don't know what that means. He's denied and sulks away. Jump the queue. You look around and realise that you care about these people, their thoughts and experiences. You want to sit for hours with each one of them, hear about their mothers and fathers, what they were doing on 9/11, how they make a living, what kind of music they listen to. A baker from Santa Fe says that everything that's happening in the park is beautiful and that he wants to break bread with the group. His loaf is passed around and is delicious and nutty. There's a journalist, and he doesn't get it. He asks all the wrong questions, but seems pleased with the answers. At night, you march along Wall Street with a group of people, all silent, with a person in front holding a black flag on a tall pole. There are about four cops per marcher following on motorcycle. The lack of speaking is chilling, and you march with loud footsteps over the silence, listening to them echo against the surrounding concrete. It's an odd tribal dance. The cops in the street, marchers on the sidewalk, eyeing each other. Representatives from the National Lawyers Guild keep pace, their neon green hats like beacons of safety amidst the dark of night and the cluster of cops. Upon returning to the park, people hold fists up at you and smile, and everything is so alive, like a flourishing ecosystem overtaking an alien structure and making it home. And you realise that you are at home, mostly, or at least something close to it. But you head for the subway where your actual home is, the home that you pay rent to live in, where you have art on the walls, books on your shelf, a cabinet full of yogi tea. It's only temporary anyway. You'll be back tomorrow at your real home. this weird place that has come to occupy your heart, this place that holds you close and tells you that you're beautiful just the way you are, that understands you and sees how amazing you can be, this place that was made for you, that you helped to make, this place where you can never be alone, can never be lost, can never be afraid, as long as you can make it work, can work with each other and respect each other's sacrifices and needs and human imperfections, this place where there is nothing to do but occupy, which is really everything we need to do and everything you want to be. It's everything.
Wow. Awesome.
You've got to check out this website. It's full of amazing stories.
What's it called again? Occupy.
Occupywriters.org.
That was great.
It smells so good.
Mic check.
My check.
Who's next?
That's how perfectly. Mm. Why that sort of vortex music.
Mm. Oh, oh, oh. Yeah. That sort of.
You're clinging your head in.
Thanks.
Hang on.
Perfect. Ooh. That'll do. Nailed it.
You sure? No, it's not good enough.
I wanted to introduce a poet called Robert Allen Guest, who was an Englishman in America. He went over there when he was a kid with his family. And kind of small-town American poet, really. But he's so... I just find him so uplifting and so... inspirational, I think. I want to start with one of my favourite poems, probably my favourite poem by Edgar Allan Guest, and it's called It Couldn't Be Done. Somebody said that it couldn't be done, but he with a chuckle replied that maybe it couldn't, but he would be one that wouldn't say so till he tried. So he buckled right in with a trace of a grin on his face. If he worried, he hid it. And he started to sing while he tackled the thing that couldn't be done, and he did it. Somebody scoffed, "Oh, you'll never do that. At least, no one has done it." But he took off his coat and he took off his hat, and the first thing we knew, he'd begun it. With a lift of his chin and a bit of a grin, without any doubting or quiddit, he started to sing as he tackled the thing that couldn't be done, and he did it. There are thousands to tell you it cannot be done. There are thousands to prophesy failure. There are thousands to point out to you, one by one, the dangers that wait to assail you. But just buckle it in with a bit of a grin. Just take off your coat and go to it. Just start to sing as you tackle the thing that couldn't be done, and you'll do it.
You sent me the link to that when I spat the dummy for the first time, didn't you?
I might have done.
About 2 dozen dummies ago.
Okay, so there are lots more. I probably won't read all of them, but there's a few that I wanted to share because they're just... because they just mean so much, and it just gives a good introduction to this guy as a poet and where he's coming from. And the next one that I wanted to read is called... no, that's the wrong one. The next one I wanted to read is... called The Need. You have to imagine a couple of old gents sitting by the fireplace. Okay. We were sitting there and smoking our pipes, discussing things like taxes, votes for women, and the tottering thrones of kings. When he ups and strokes his whiskers with his hand and he says to me, "Changing laws and legislatures ain't, as far as I can see, gonna make this world much better, unless somehow we can find a way to make a better and a finer sort of man. The trouble ain't with statutes or with systems, not at all. It's with humans, just like we are, and their petty ways and small. We could stop our writing law books and our regulating rules if a better sort of manhood was the product of our schools. For the things that we are needing isn't writing from a pen or bigger guns to shoot with, but a bigger type of men. I reckon all these problems are just ordinary, like the weeds. They grow in soil that ought to nourish only decent deeds. And they waste our time and fret us when, if we were thinking straight and living right, they wouldn't be so terrible and great. A good horse needs no snaffle, and a good man, I opine, doesn't need a law to check him or to force him into line. If we ever start in teaching to our children year by year how to live with one another, there'll be less a trouble here. If we'd teach them how to neighbour and to walk in honour's ways, we could settle every problem which the man of mind could raise. What we're needing isn't systems or some regulating plan, but a bigger and a finer and a truer type of man. Okay, very short one now, just because I like it, so I thought. It's called Opportunity. So long as men shall be on earth, there will be tasks for them to do. Some way for them to show their worth. Each day shall bring its problems new. And men shall dream of mightier deeds than ever been done before. Their ways shall be human needs for men to work and struggle for. No, there always will be human needs for men to work and struggle for. Sorry, I screwed up the last line of that one. Okay,
right.
Let me find something else now. What did I have next? Okay, this one I've chosen kind of... I like the way that it turns... You know, I like the fact that we're sitting in a churchyard when I tell this. This is called Sermons We See. I'd rather see a sermon than hear one any day. I'd rather one should walk with me than merely tell the way. The eye's a better pupil and more willing than the ear. Fine counsel is confusing, but example's always clear. And the best of all the preachers are the men who live their creeds. For to see good put into action is what everybody needs. I soon can learn to do it if you'll let me see it done. I can watch your hands in action, but your tongue may too fast run. And the lecture you deliver may be very wise and true, but I'd rather get my lessons by observing what you do. For I might misunderstand you and the high advice you give, but there's no misunderstanding how you act and how you live. When I see a deed of kindness, I am eager to be kind. When a weaker brother stumbles and a strong man stays behind just to see if he can help him, then the wish grows strong in me to become as big and thoughtful as I know that friend to be. And all travellers can witness that the best of guides today is not the one who tells them, but the one who shows the way. One good man teaches many, men believe what they behold. One deed of kindness noticed is worth 40 that are told. Who stands with men of honour learns to hold his honour dear. For right living speaks a language which to everyone is clear. Though an able speaker charms me with his eloquence, I say I'd rather see a sermon than hear one any day.
Yay!
Okay, there's a couple more. I want to read then something which is another uplifting one, something that inspires me, and it's called Results and Roses. The man who wants a garden fair, or small or very big, with flowers growing here and there, must bend his back and dig. The things are mighty few on earth that wishes can attain. Whatever we want of any worth, we've got to work to gain. It matters not what goal you seek, its secret here reposes. You've got to dig from week to week to get results or roses. Okay, don't know how we're doing for time. Let me just find one more and then maybe we can come back later.
One of yours.
You want one of mine?
Yeah.
Yes.
One of yours.
You sure?
Yeah.
Okay.
You can't sit back down until you do.
Okay, we'll do one. I want to do one more by Edgar and then we'll read one of mine.
Yay.
Okay. This is called Myself. I have to live with myself, and so I want to be fit for myself to know. I want to be able, as days go by, always to look myself straight in the eye. I don't want to stand with the setting sun and hate myself for the things I have done. I don't want to keep on a closet shelf a lot of secrets about myself and fool myself as I come and go into thinking no one else will ever know the kind of person I really am. I don't want to dress myself up in a sham. I want to go out with my head erect. I want to deserve all men's respect. But here in the struggle for fame and wealth, I want to be able to like myself. I don't want to look at myself and know that I am bluster and bluff and empty show. I never can hide myself from me, so I see what others may never see. I know what others may never know. I know I never can fool myself, and so, whatever happens, I want to be self-respecting and conscience-free. Yeah. All right, that's enough, Edgar. Have I got to tell one of my poems?
Yes, please.
Okay. I wrote a poem a long, long, long time ago. I started writing a poem a long, long, long time ago. It's called Fate. There's a fire on the hills, and it's reddening the sky. It spreads its arms and slowly kills. I daren't ask the reasons why. Are they selling out their homes? Cut the trees and burn the land? It took a million years to grow, but now it's gone for cash in hand to satisfy the Western man. I see footsteps in the sand leading back to yesteryear, where the Indians fought so brave while their families hid in fear. $5 for every scalp, the cowboy carries all he can. He says he's only trying to help the never-ending caravan to build new homes for Western man. I see rainbows on the sea, reflecting battles lost and won. Said they were fighting to be free, but when will that freedom come? Do we even know our path? Should we retrace it while we can? Because tomorrow comes so fast and holds the power in her hand to change the fate of Western man.
Nice. Thank you. Thank you. That one.
That's it.
Oh, this is good fun. I'm enjoying this.
I've recently spent about 6 years writing a thesis on alchemy. Sort of on alchemy. Part of it's about alchemy. Given it's the year 2012, I thought, you know, I'd like to bring up a topic that concerns me and, you know, which I try to avoid or ignore, but it really is present in my mind. It's the end of the world, sort of. I don't want to be too pessimistic about things, but in my mind I see this world, this beautiful ancient world, this jewel in the universe, slowly being eaten by a giant serpent. A serpent with big metal teeth and venomous acid, poison, covering land, eating all the life that it can see. There's a word for this serpent, this dragon, which we humans, we hold its harness, we hold its reins, and that word is alchemy, or at least in modern times it's called, you know, chemistry. Because, you know, with stone axes we can only do so much. With fire, it eventually burns itself out, but some weird potency, metal, acid, and particularly in the modern world, oil. I don't see alchemy as a particularly bad thing. I think people are mostly ignorant of it. You know, we take the world, we change its form, we change its chemical form, give it a new shape, you know, and then what do we do with that? Well, it's up to us. We can create beautiful artworks, we can heal, we can find, you know, better ways to garden or whatnot, or we could just, I don't know, find ways to trade it for gold, to make weapons. Alchemy started a long time ago. Western scholars mostly agree that it started in Egypt. It's where the word alchemy comes from. Egypt used to be known as the land of the black sands, and the word Kemia was the word for Egypt. It means black. So it's black art. But it used to have other names. It used to be called the sacred art, or the art of liquids. No, the word plastic is so alchemical, because if you think about the word plastic, it means liquid, you know, something which flows. It's kind of ironic. It doesn't flow. It stays the same. It's not like water. Although it is, if, you know, if you have the right recipe. But the ancient people in Egypt who began this art, I think they knew a lot more about it, had a lot more respect for it than we have today. Their gods were not some god on the other side of death, you know, or outside the universe. Their god was nature. Their gods was the sky and the earth. And they saw that as something to be respected before their own human power of creation. One of one of the oldest manuscripts, one of the oldest writings about alchemy is ascribed to a lady named Cleopatra. And she describes the first alchemical machine. It's called a reflux condenser, or still. We use it to make moonshine. The aqua vitae? Anyone heard of aqua vitae? Ethanol. But the word aqua vitae means the water of life. Literally the elixir of life, you know. It's still used in medicine today. And yeah, used properly, aqua vitae can heal. Used improperly, it can poison. And this you know, reflux condenser, it's also used for distilling gold and silver out of quartz. You know, crush up rock and make gold. And that was, I suppose, the original philosopher's stone before they turned it into legends. I think the power of chemistry today is so fantastic, the things that we can create, if we were to turn them into legends. 1,000 years ago, they wouldn't believe us. They wouldn't believe that we could make anything that we could dream of. They were limited to what stone and metal and wood. We have all these wonderful machines, flying things and televisions and, you know, and so forth. Sorry, it's a bit rambling, a bit tangential, but... Right. Yeah, Cleopatra. She described this machine as like a serpent eating its tail, sort of goes back on itself, a great serpent. And she called the serpent one, or all, one and all.
Ouroboros.
Ouroboros, yeah. She actually drew it as a hidden shape. There's a hidden shape in nature, you know. We see, you know, spheres around, or straight lines, or discs, or all these shapes. There's a hidden shape. It's called a Möbius loop, which doesn't occur in nature in anywhere that we can see it. I believe that this shape was used also by the ancient religions, but that's another story. Cleopatra, she borrowed this shape and she drew the serpent in this shape. This one is all. But for her, it was a symbol of alchemy, and she said, one is the serpent with poison of two combinations. That's true. You know, it has two combinations. It can poison, or it can heal. And we humans, we hold the reins. It's up to us how we use it, or abuse it. She also wrote, one is all, and through it is all, and by it is all, and if you have not all, then you have nothing. And I think she's just trying to help us remember that this stuff that we make, this alchemical stuff, is so radically different from the natural world, yet it's always a part of the natural world. It can't be removed from it. And if we don't keep in mind everything, that it's all one thing, then we'll end up with nothing. I found this other manuscript. I suppose I can finish on this. It's called the Dialogue of Cleopatra and the Philosophers. And on one hand, it's a recipe for making metal or something. On the other hand, it's sort of like a spiritual poetry. And I'll read it, if I may. Then Cleopatra said to the philosophers, "Look at the nature of plants, whence they come. For some come down from the mountains and grow out of the earth, and some grow up from the valleys and come from the plains. But look how they develop, for it is at certain seasons and days that you must gather them, and take them from the islands of the sea and from their most lofty places, and look at the air which ministers to them, and the nourishment circling around them, that they perish not nor die. Look at the divine water which gives them drink, and the air that governs them after they have been given a body in a single being." Now Austin's, who's a teacher, and those with him, the philosophers, answered Cleopatra, "In thee is concealed a strange and terrible mystery. Enlighten us, casting your light upon the elements. Tell us how the highest descends to the lowest, and how the lowest rises to the highest, and how that which is in the midst approaches the highest and is united to it. And what is the element which accomplishes these things? And tell us how the blessed waters visit the corpses lying in Hades, fetid and afflicted in darkness, and how the medicine of life reaches them and rouses them as if wakened by their possessors from sleep, and how the new waters, both brought on the bier and coming after the light, penetrate them at the beginning of their prostration, and how a cloud supports them, and how the cloud supporting the waters rises from the seas." Cleopatra said to them, "The waters, when they come, awake the bodies and the spirits which are imprisoned and weak, for they again undergo oppression and are enclosed in Hades, and yet in a little while they grow and rise up and put on diverse glorious colours like the flowers in springtime, and spring itself rejoices and is glad at the beauty that they wear. For I tell you this to you who are wise, when you take plants, elements, and stones from their places, they appear to you to be mature. They are not mature until the fire has tested them. When they are clothed in glory from the fire and the shining colour thereof, then rather will appear their hidden glory, their sought-for beauty, being transformed to the divine state of fusion. For they are nourished in the fire, and the embryo grows little by little, nourished in its mother's womb. And when the appointed month approaches, is not restrained from issuing forth. Such is the procedure of this worthy art. The waves and surges, one after another in Hades, wound them in the tomb where they lie. When the tomb is opened, they issue from Hades as a babe from the womb."
Hey, brother.
Yeah, when I read this is also my first time reading it, so I don't even know what it's going to be about. It's going to be an experience. Minor. Right, Legends of Animals. That's a book about Aboriginal stories of Australia. Legend of Animals. The last of his tribe, he crouches and buries his face on his knees and hides in the dark of his hair, for he cannot look up to the storm-smitten trees or think of the loneliness there, or the loss and the loneliness there. The walrus grope through the tufts of the grass and turn there converts for fear. Is that understandable?
Yeah.
All right. But he sits in the ashes and lets them pass, where the boomerangs leap with the spear, with the nula, the sling, and the spear. What's a nula?
Fries a spear.
Ah, okay. Ulula, behold him, the thunder that breaks on the tops of the rocks with the rain, and the wind which drives up with the salt of the lakes, have made him a hunter again, a hunter and fisher again.
For his eyes have been filled with a smoldering thought, but he dreams of the haunt of yore. And yore, Y-O-R-E. What's that?
Past. History.
The past.
Yeah. Ah. And of foes that is that he sought, and of fights that he fought, with those will battle no more, who will go to the battle no more. It is well that the water which tumbles and fills goes mowing and mowing alone. For an echo rolls out from the sides of the hill, and he starts at the wonderful song, at the sound of the wonderful song. And he sees through the rents of the scattering fox the corroby warlike and green. Corroby?
Corroboree.
And the lubra, who sat by the fire of the logs, to watch like a mourner for him, like a mother and mourner for him. Will he go in his sleep from the desolate lands, like a chief to the rest of his race, with the honey-voiced woman who reckons in his tent, and gleams like a dream in his face, like a marvelous dream in his face? Well, it says here, sorry about that, let me see. Nah, yeah, that's it. It's kind of... Yeah, it's good. This time I read it, so...
Nice, lovely chocolatey rhythm.
I do want to just quickly off the cuff, but I haven't brought any. But I'm going to speak. I'm going to sit in the hot seat and just say, perfectly honest, when I heard that there was a spoken word arranged, I thought, that's delightful. How fuzzy, how delightful, you know. And perhaps it felt like putting a band-aid on a spontaneous amputation. And I think I've been once again surprised by the power of narrative, and I do believe that everything and everyone is really just a narrative, because it's the meaning we bring to it. And it has been extraordinary to sit and listen to what everyone's brought to share with each other, and I'm ashamed that I had not embraced the process similarly, because I'm sure that I would have felt better to contribute more equally. But what I wanted to say was that this whole experience, and particularly Emma, the reading that Emma brought, that sort of snapped it back and reminded us why we're here. And I remember Matt's like, you know, just try and do the impossible, because that's what we're here to do, is to tackle the impossible. And it has been an extraordinary test. It's been an extraordinary test for me, you know, just in terms of the endurance required to last, the tenacity required, the patience, and the stupidity. And I think also that the hardest thing that I've found tested has been my faith. And faith in the collective, you know, as someone who believes that power should be wrested from the few, that we should take responsibility for our own futures and our own directions, sometimes that faith has been shaken. And I felt it little by little being restored with every word. So for that, I'd like to thank you. And we shall march boldly on to victory. Thank you.
Yay. 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 Yay.
Okay. Oh, you got that, hippies.
So I have, believe it or not, I have a prior engagement which I'm going to stick to, and I feel dreadful dipping out because I'm getting really into it. But once again, first aid and care have led by example, which is the best way to do anything. And once again, you're breaking new ground, and I think that we can all learn from this example and hopefully emulate it across the board. Yeah?
Yeah, this is the first of many. Tell the other
solidarity system.
Oh, I'm gonna dig something up.
Cool.
And for the next one, because I'm in for this spoken word. Yeah. Right? Thanks, guys.
We'll
Thank
story.
Bye.
Bye.
Yay, cheers. Can I ask for an intermission?
You may, sister.
Intermission.
How many more people have we got to go?
More people have we got? Okay.
I've got more.
Read one
There's more.
Yeah.
Cool.
Okay.
She's got a couple more.
Love you all. See you.
Bye bye.
I've got another story.
You got more, Jason?
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll go around again. Yeah.
Intermission.
But let's have an intermission. That would be a good idea.
Come back and go around too.
I need to see if I've actually got any levels on this thing.
This is awesome.